is Extinction Rebellion.
Welcome to the Rebellion.
Welcome to Extinction Rebellion Radio and WBAI with Matthew Kearney and Elise Lane. Extinction Rebellion is an international movement that uses nonviolent direct action to press for action on the climate emergency. You know, there's a lot of fencing going on, fencing at national borders, trying to keep out migrants. But you might as well try using a screen door to keep out the ocean, really. Rather than fences and barriers, we actually need planning on an international level for the migration that's going on, that's going to come from the climate crisis. Now, here's why. As the planet heats and heats and heats some more, we can't predict exactly when the mass migrations will occur or exactly where they will go. But we can predict that there will be some mass migrations, right? We know that some coastal areas will flood, maybe some larger territories too. We know deserts will expand. That's already happening, for example, in China. But they're going to expand some more. And we know that hurricanes will destroy built environments and leave people with nothing. That's already happening. It's going to continue to happen. And we are pretty sure that for at least part of the year, temperatures in the very hottest places will reach levels where human bodies simply cannot survive. Now, although that hasn't happened yet, it's likely, right? It's on the radar screen. Air conditioning can save you until the grid breaks down, but would you still live in a place where you would die if your air conditioner failed, or where you would die if your car broke down? I wouldn't. So people are going to move, and probably a lot of people are going to move many times more than are already moving. Now, the relatively small level of migration we have now is going smoothly, right? It's not causing any problems at all, right?
No problem. No.
Look, all the world knows that migration has generated massive political instability in the United States, not so much from the migrants themselves, but from the reaction to them, or even one might say the reaction to the idea of them. President Trump's singular campaign promise was to build a quote unquote wall on the Mexican border. That promise got him so much support, it helped make him a plausible electoral contender. And that was a national response to even small levels of migration. The family separations that ensued under the Trump administration are going to be remembered as one of the darkest chapters in modern American history. It's going to be up there with, say, Jim Crow and the Japanese internment camps and the CIA torture sites. It's that awful. Now, although they may no longer be separating families, at least as far as we know, the bad news from the Texas border is coming almost too fast to keep up with. The huge encampment under the bridge seems to have developed very quickly. Get ready for more of that. The surprise flights to Haiti. I read that our brothers and sisters weren't even told where the plane was going. They were shocked to find themselves in Haiti. In some cases, they hadn't been in Haiti for many years and they were just dumped there. No resources, not to mention, of course, the carbon emissions from those flights that none of the passengers even wanted to take. You know, the American envoy to Haiti resigned in protest. He said he didn't want to be part of such an anti-humanitarian practice. And this is the Biden administration, folks, not the Trump administration that's overseeing all of this. It's the continuity of colonial forms of domination.
But in addition, Elise, those images of the Border Patrol agents on horseback corralling the Haitian migrants who were trying to enter the United States on foot. My goodness. That AFP photograph of the agent on horseback leaning over to grab the Haitian man by his shirt is going to go down in history.
It's outrageous.
Yeah. Oof. People will be looking at that image years from now. Conservative media are pointing out forcefully that there's no evidence that agents were whipping the migrants. But even if that's true, there's a lot of things wrong here besides whipping, besides the leather making contact with the skin. And it definitely adds a sharp edge to the whole situation that these were white men on horseback and black men on foot. But even if the ethnicities had been different, all is not well with humanity when a man on horseback is grabbing bodily another man on foot who is running away. All is not well with humanity when a man on horseback runs his horse directly at a boy We can't tell his age from the video, but he looks perhaps 12 or so. The boy runs back as the horse runs straight at him. This man on horseback is threatening to trample the boy. If the boy doesn't move, he's going to get trampled by that horse. That happened. It was caught on video. This is border enforcement in 2021. This is the migration situation in 2021. Race is all over this situation, I think. Doesn't it seem like he would not have threatened to trample a white boy? Doesn't it seem like he would have thought twice before putting a white boy's life and limb in danger? But that agent on horseback just ran right at the black boy. So like I said, it's wrong no matter what the race involved, but it's this sharper edge when it's a white man on horseback and black men and black boys on foot. Some conservative commentators I've read are saying, well, that's just their job. They're border patrol agents. The concept of border patrol means that someone is supposed to patrol the border and prevent unauthorized people from entering if they can. But I ask you, if this is what's required to enforce the border, doesn't that make you think twice about the premise of enforcing the border? Isn't that enough to call into question our current migration laws and arrangements? If running horses straight at boys is what border enforcement means, then who wants that kind of border enforcement? The United States is not the only country that's flipping out over migration. Lithuania, that's on the eastern edge of the European Union, is building a fence on its border with Belarus, not to keep out the Belarusians, but to keep out the Iraqis and Afghans who are transiting through Belarus. The BBC article reporting on this also mentions, quote, other non-EU migrants, unquote, but doesn't say whether these people are from Africa or from other parts of the Middle East or from Eastern Europe or where.
You know, for similar reasons, Poland is planning to build a fence on its border with Belarus. They just announced this in September. And so the European Union is partially fencing itself off as well. And Greece is adding fencing to its border with Turkey. That is a big crossing spot, the Greece-Turkey border. Turkey is a land route to Europe and from the Middle East and North Africa. One could get there by water, and people die every month trying to do it. One could also try to get to Europe through Russia, but it's a much longer way. So Turkey has been accumulating migrants and refugees for years now, and the land route is Turkey to Greece through the Balkans to Germany. If any part of that route gets blocked, you'll get an accumulation of people at the blockage point. And that's already happening, right? Turkey is expressing its displeasure with the Greek wall on its border, saying it will not be, quote, Europe's migrant storage unit, end quote. That's quoted in the BBC. But the ministry or spokesperson isn't identified. So Turkey is complaining about this, and it has been for a while, but perhaps on the rationale of, if you can't beat them, join them. It has begun building a wall on its eastern border with Iran to try to stop refugees from entering there. So how will this play out if and when migration from the Middle East were to greatly increase, or migration from further east? What about migration from India and the Indian subcontinent of Bangladesh if Bangladesh floods as it's expected to? Think about the size of the populations of Bangladesh and India. There's over a billion people in India now. Now, obviously, they aren't all going to migrate, but quite a few will. What if thousands of migrants turns into millions? In the worst case scenarios that we can't rule out, what if it's hundreds of millions of human beings who have to move or die? Obviously, some fencing isn't going to keep out that level of pressure, even if it's guarded with armed troops. You'll have some ugly incidents at the borders, but if it's numbers on that scale, if people want to get through, then they're going to get through.
They are. So what's going to happen? Should we just open the borders? There's naturally a lot of uncertainty about what would happen if borders were just opened without restriction. The United States and the European Union are facing this question. They're facing it now. And the issue is only going to get worse from here. Now, I don't buy the claims that you sometimes hear that we, quote unquote, don't have a country without a strictly enforced border, that somehow a country requires a fenced border in order to exist. like the country would dissolve if there wasn't a fence. That's rarely been the case in history. Fences are rare historically. The United States had open borders when most white people's ancestors came over. My ancestors from Ireland did not get a visa. They just got on a boat and showed up. In New York, Ellis Island did a health check, and it wrote down the names, and then people got in. No language requirement, no financial resource requirement, at least not one that was enforced robustly. We could go back to that, health checks and name registrations, and in you go. Now, most borders in the world are open, physically speaking, as in there's not a physical barrier on them. So this idea that we don't have a country if we don't have strict borders doesn't make a lot of sense to me, despite the fact that a few politicians like to repeat it ad infinitum. A country can choose whether to open or close its border. If you let migrants in, that doesn't mean that the legal border disappears. It's a country's choice when to open and close. Opening temporarily or indefinitely doesn't dissolve the country. And of course, there are a lot of options between completely open and completely closed. Which of those options is best? This isn't an easy question. It's not obvious what is best to do.
You're listening to Extinction Rebellion Radio with Matthew Kearney and Elise Lane, and we're talking today about migration and our climate crisis. You know, Matt, but in deciding what to do, we have to be aware of the climate crisis. Yep. The climate is affecting the situation profoundly. My impression is that current discussions of migration are considering the current situation, not considering the future situation. And I seriously wonder if those in power are considering the future and the fact that the flow of people is going to increase. Some of the things to do that look like they might be useful for the current situation of thousands of people be futile and misguided if the flow becomes millions of people. A Band-Aid can heal a surface cut, but not a deep cut. And suppose the US and the EU do come up with some border measures that get portrayed in the media, you know, as a balance between controlled migration and open borders, regulated pathways to citizenship that might work electorally. But the social justice crowd and moderates and perhaps quite a few conservatives would be happy. And in a campaign and in the press, it might look like real progress. It might be popular, might get people elected. Democrats or Republicans could maybe get elected touting that as an accomplishment. Measures to regulate the current situation.
But those measures will wither in the years to come. For some of the reasons you were just talking about. You plan for 10,000 people and a million people show up and your plan goes completely out the window. So I share your fear that they're not planning for the future crisis, Elise. I fear that they're just thinking about the current crisis. And if that's true, it's almost wasted effort. Whatever solution they come up with, if they even do come up with any sort of solution, is not going to last. So what should we do? Well, I wish I could tell you that I knew everything to do and had the comprehensive plan for global resettlement. The fact is nobody has that plan on that comprehensive level. The United Nations doesn't have it. Governments don't have it. The major NGOs don't have it. The demography and geography university departments that specialize in migration don't have it. Extinction Rebellion doesn't have it. I don't have it. Elise, do you have it?
Not at the moment.
Didn't think so. But I think we can get one. I think we can get one that won't be perfect, but will be a whole lot better than nothing. The various international players need to sit down and try to plan this out. They need to do it with the best information available about how climate is going to change over the next decades, if not on a longer time span than that, and our best information available about what social effects that will have. If there are studies that need to be done, and I think there are because I think we don't know enough about how and whether people will move, then let's fund those studies. For the Western Hemisphere, for instance, you would get a summit or a series of summits with the Latin American countries and the major civil society groups, and consider including some sort of citizens' assembly or ordinary folks with the United States and Canada, all sitting down, with the United Nations perhaps convening or certainly at the table, all together think about what's rational for where to put people who can't live in the area where they were born. Now, that group won't come up with a perfect solution, but again, what they will come up with is going to be a long shot better than having no plan at all. And it's going to be a lot better than trying with ever-increasing utility to fence ourselves in. Merely fencing is sort of the anti-planning approach to this crisis. Planning on an international level will reduce the chaos. That's where we're going with this. Planning on an international level will reduce the chaos. By the way, I do support a pathway to citizenship for immigrants, and quite possibly Elise does too. But one of the things that follows from what we're saying here is that for existing immigrants, doing this pathway to citizenship for existing immigrants is not sufficient for addressing the climate migration problem. There is going to be way more immigration. No matter what you do, there is going to be more. We have no alternative other than to figure out how to live with that.
Of course, Matt, there's another type of migration, climate migration, and that's animal and insect migration. It's continuing apace. For example, just a small example, dragonflies are moving northward in Iceland and in Britain. There's a new report about this using a lot of data, 1.4 million observation points, saying the dragonflies are going significantly further northward than they've been gone before. In fact, here's a good fun fact. The dragonfly was one of the first winged insects to evolve. They've been around for 300 million years, and they're trying to survive now. 300 million years. There are many species of dragonfly, not just one, and some species are appearing in Britain for the first time. They were on the European continent, and they migrated northward in a quest for survival, like a latter-day Dunkirk across the English Channel, because the temperatures are changing. Icelandic fishermen are starting to catch mackerel. They never used to. That's because this fish species is migrating north, trying to find the right water temperature for themselves. On land, beavers are going north. Those little furry fellows are making their way from southern Canada closer and closer to the Arctic Circle, which, of course, is starting to burn up. They are just as cute when they're further north as they were before, but they're bringing the little mites that live in their fur with them, and that's contaminating the ponds and lakes up there when those beavers go for a swim. So no one species surviving and thriving in a new habitat can mean the opposite for other species. And of course, all the world knows about the penguins and their vanishing ice habitats, making them an endangered species. As Antarctica melts, there is nowhere for the penguins to migrate to. And as the ice melts, they are running out of options. Migration isn't always an option.
Microscopic things migrate too. For example, higher altitudes used to be safe from malaria. But now malaria is being reported in humans who live higher and higher up in mountains because as it gets warmer up there, the mosquitoes are able to survive at higher altitudes. And of course, they bring their diseases with them. These animal and insect migrations we've been giving examples of are going to keep happening. In fact, they're going to accelerate. Some animals and insects are mobile, as we've said, and some are not, as we've said. And the ones that aren't mobile will be stuck in a hotter place than they evolved to live in, like the Komodo dragon, a magnificent animal if you've ever seen one. I saw one in the Shedd Aquarium in Chicago. That tail just keeps going and going all day long. So this animal, the Komodo dragon, is the largest lizard on Earth. Like other lizards, it's cold-blooded, so it is the temperature of its surroundings. Its body is heavy, and we would not predict that it could migrate long distances. And naturalists are saying, indeed, it's not migrating. The Komodo dragons are staying put. And who knows if they will survive as their habitat changes. They're an endangered species now. The animals who are mobile have a chance of finding the right temperatures. But they'll be in a different habitat than they evolved to occupy, with perhaps a different food supply than they evolved to eat. Some animal species will be fine, and some will go extinct.
Yeah, some will go extinct. You know, countries are cutting off each other's water supply now. According to the New York Times, Ukraine is blocking a northern Crimean canal that links the Dnieper River to the Crimean Peninsula. Now, it's a big water source, and there's drought almost everywhere now, including in Crimea. So what is going on here is we have one country obstructing the water supply of another for geopolitical reasons. And the tensions between Russia and Ukraine existed before global warming, of course. But why it hurts Russia to stop this canal now is because there's a water shortage. Otherwise, this wouldn't be a big deal. The dystopian climate-warped future where countries hoard water from others has already arrived. And, you know, I mean, in California, we're already debating what's going to happen with the Colorado River. You know, the climate crisis is hitting Africa, and it's hitting Africa hard. We've noted on this program that you don't hear a lot of news from Africa in the mainstream Western press. You usually have to go specifically looking for it, usually in alternative presses. And that's true of African climate news as well. That's a problem for equity and information, but it's also a problem for our global picture of what's happening, right? Naturally, you don't want to think about the climate crisis only in local or regional terms. The climate crisis can only really be understood in global terms, and Africa is the second largest continent in the world after Asia, so you can't ignore it.
Shouldn't ignore it. Africa is going to see some of the earliest impacts from global heating. And here's an example. The longest freshwater lake in the world is Lake Tanganyika. They taught us how to pronounce it back in junior high school. Lake Tanganyika. Now, Lake Superior, between the United States and Canada, is larger than Tanganyika, but Tanganyika is longer from one end to the other. It borders Burundi, Tanzania, the Democratic Republic of Congo, and Zambia. And this lake is breaking its banks. It is rising 3.5 meters higher than normal, per the BBC. 3.5 meters, folks. That's almost 11.5 feet. So think about 11 feet of water rise. Homes and farms are getting swallowed up. So people lose their livelihoods and they become destitute. And in that state, they have to migrate in destitution. As you can imagine, with the biggest lake in the region, there's economic activity around it. That's where they put the ports. Trade goes through those ports, and the relatively wealthy people put their homes near there. It's a freshwater lake, so it's a good idea to put your farm near there for irrigation. And people have been doing that for a long, long time, maybe thousands of years, living, co-living with Lake Tanganyika. And now that lake is breaking those ancient banks and destroying a lot of that development. This is Extinction Rebellion Radio on WBAI 99.5 FM New York, co-hosted by Elise Lane and Matthew Kearney. This week, we are talking about Lake Tanganyika in Africa bursting its banks and rising from excessive rain. So this is not sea level rise. This is an inland lake. This is different from the oceans rising. In this case, it's heavy storms, which we've talked about on this show. More heat makes more rain. The rise in Lake Tanganyika is a product of the climate crisis. Without global heating, it would not be rising like it is.
Several rivers drain into this lake, so when there's a big storm anywhere in the region, the rain ends up in Lake Tanganyika. And if there are several heavy storms back to back, that lake is going to rise and it's going to flood everything that's around it. So what do people do under those circumstances? Well, they go live in refugee camps. According to a Save the Children report, 85% of those in camps in Burundi are there because of natural disasters. It's only 15% who are there because of conflict. 85% of homeless Burundians were displaced by natural disasters. That's the state of things in South Central Africa right now in the year 2021.
This has been Extinction Rebellion Radio.
friends. I'm Linda Perry, Program Director here at WBAI Radio. Join me and our station manager, Bertol Reimers, for a report to the listener. That's this Wednesday, October 13th from 3 to 5 p.m. We'll discuss the current state of the station, programming, and other issues of interest to you, our listeners. That's Wednesday, October 13th from 3 to 5 p.m. right here on WBAI New York.
Well, you know that local station board meeting that I've been telling you about that takes place this Wednesday, October 13th at 7 p.m.? Well, I've been pointing people to the KPFTX website where you can find the access information for the meeting, which will be held via Zoom. However, I've also been reliably informed that most WBAI listeners do not have a computer. So now I'm going to tell you how you can dial into the meeting yourself. By the way, the meeting is accessible to the public and includes an opportunity for public comment. So here's what you got to do. You can access the meeting by calling 929-205-6099. You got that? Write it down, kids. 929-205-6099. And then you enter this meeting ID, 922.457.2995. Got that? 922.457.2995. And since that wasn't nearly enough numbers, there's also a password. The password is 995, like WBAI's frequency, 99.5. So it's 995.995.99. Did you get that? 995.995.99. And we hope you will join us at the WBAI local station board meeting Wednesday, October 13th at 7 p.m. You're tuned to listener-sponsored and non-commercial WBAI in New York.
Greetings, this is Dr. James McIntosh, host of Mindfield, which comes to you every Wednesday at 2 p.m. on WBAI 99.5 FM. Together with my co-host, nurse family therapist, Richardina Theodore, we delve into the explosive issues in mental health. Our mission is to help you know yourself, release your anxieties and your depression, and free your mind. Only on WBAI, the voice of the voiceless, can we voiceless ones be heard. Support the show and WBAI by donating at give2wbai.org. That's the word give, the number 2, at wbai.org. Or by calling 212-209-2950. That's 212-209-2950. You can support the show and the station even more by going to give2wbai.org and giving a monthly donation of as little as $10 per month as a WBAI buddy to your favorite show on WBAI 99.5 FM.
And the previous program was Extinction Rebellion Radio, heard Tuesdays at 6:30.